Welcome to the Sons of Liberty podcast, coming to you from the Liberty Tree Studio in San Antonio, Texas, where we discuss topics of the day, firearms, great food, and even better whiskey. Grab a drink, sit down with your host, the founding daddies, Mike Mahalski and Kyle Grothus.
Howdy, guys. Kyle here with Sons of Liberty, coming to the podcast. We've got Mike. We've got Clark Kernett, who is our barrel in-house barrel expert, does all our custom work and prototyping and things like that. We'll let him introduce himself in a bit. And then we also got Philip Preacher, is one of our armors and JV shooting team members.
Damn.
Facts.
Damn.
It's an inside joke, since they got shirts made and everything, so I'm allowed to say it.
Yeah, Phil's actually an incredible shooter. He competes quite a bit, and it's... A lot of folks don't realize that our armorers actually also do shoot. You know, that's kind of important, that not only can you know how to build a gun, but you're actually out there shooting, and that gives you quite a bit of depth in how you do your job, because you understand performance. But Phil, I don't think you're on the JV. You outshoot me, that's for damn sure.
That is true. We took an LVPO course together and you beat me, so yeah, I can't talk shit, I guess.
So what I wanted to achieve with this podcast is we have a couple of end users here. Clark competes quite a bit. I mean, you actually compete pretty much every week.
A lot, yes. Almost every single weekend I'm shooting a match of some sort somewhere.
How long have you been doing this?
I've been continuously competitive shooting in one discipline or another since 2000.
Okay, so 23 years. Mm-hmm. Okay, then all right. And Preach, I mean, when did you start competitively shooting?
Around 2010, so...
Okay.
Give or take 13 years.
13 years. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll be honest. Like, I'm not a competitive shooter. I love to shoot. I used to shoot a hell of a lot more before I started Sons Liberty Gunworks. It's kind of funny that whenever you do this day in and day out, and all you talk about is guns day in and day out, sometimes the weekend comes around and you just want to go do some fishing. But I do want to get out to a match with you.
Yes.
So let's do a nerd alert real quick. Nerd alert. This podcast might get a little overly technical. It might be a little bit more information about stuff than you might want, but there is a huge, huge issue when it comes to understanding barrels, precision, lifespan, materials, techniques, all this kind of good stuff. And so I want to get into barrels, and this is going to be, if you're interested in the nerdy tech stuff, man, this is for you. If not, listen for as long as you can, and if you have any questions, leave them in the comments, and all of us here are going to be paying attention to that stuff and responding as best we can. But, so, Clark, now you do a lot of our custom chambering. Mm-hmm. We need prototype barrels made. We have special projects where we need, like, absolute performance that come to your lair, your secret workshop. What kind of equipment are you using in there?
So mine are all manual machines. One of them's the one I use the most is a Sharp 1340 VS lathe. It's a very high precision lathe, but yet it said it's all manual. None of this is CNC. Everything that I do is geared with one purpose in mind, and that is to squeeze as much precision as I can out of that barrel.
Speak for themselves. When I need to send a barrel off for a special project or a special client and it absolutely positively has to crush, it's coming through your shop.
You know, and obviously that takes a considerable amount of time, effort, energy, tooling, you know, and extreme tolerance, you know, and that doesn't happen fast.
One of the things I found most fascinating when I was the first started hanging out and watching what you do, can you explain to me those indicator dials that you use? Or explain for people listening what those indicator dials are and how they're used and the sensitivity of them.
Yeah, so I've got indicators that I use for dialing in the barrels to concentricity, you know, at both ends. And the indicators that I use the most are 1/10 thou of tolerance.
So 1/10 thou of tolerance. Can you give somebody how would they picture 1/10 thou?
Well, so a human hair on average is about 3 thou.
Okay.
So divide that by 30.
So divide a human hair by 30, and that's the tolerance
of 1/10 thou.
Okay, and that's the indicators that you're using whenever you're talking about actual concentricity.
Yes.
Okay, and you're talking about concentricity from the chamber to the bore.
We're dialing them into concentricity in the groove.
In the groove. Okay.
Yes. Not the top of the lands, but in the bottom of the groove.
So the bottom of the groove is what you're using to.
Yes.
Okay. Now we're talking. When we talk about concentricity, we're talking about concentricity. Obviously, a concentric chamber is paramount to precision.
Absolutely. The goal is to get everything on the same axis.
Okay. Now from right. the chamber to the muzzle. To explain that to me, because as a layman.
Well, so the way I kind of the analogy that I use is think of like a roller coaster. What matters is where you get on and where you get off. What happens in between doesn't really matter, right? As long as the bullet exits the muzzle the same way every single time, it will be precise. So barrel straightness is not a factor in precision. Bore straightness is not a factor in precision. You know, one of the things that we've seen, you know, is manufacturing processes have improved to the point to where barrels as a whole across the board are inherently straighter. The bores are straighter than what they were in past years. You know, run out between the ID and the OD is much tighter tolerance as well.
Not for people listening to that maybe not don't understand this or can't picture it. You're not talking about like a banana here. When you're talking about straightness, explain what straightness means.
Yeah, more like an eggplant.
It doesn't look like it's jumping rope. You know, in an extreme case scenario, you know, yes, you're still going to have some degree of arc to that hole, right? Some degree of inconsistency of ID to OD wall thickness around the circumference at various points in that barrel. Where that can become detrimental is if that hole is so crooked or has enough curvature going through there that I have one side where I have a very thin wall thickness and a side where I have a very thick wall thickness. After repeated shots, as that barrel continues to heat up, it will cause it to perform, you know, or to do strange things, you know. But far and wide, the tolerances have gotten much better over the years. That's far less of a concern.
And this is improvements like in gun drilling technology?
Gun drilling, reaming, yes.
Okay. So when you start, whenever we send you a 6mm blank for you to cut, like these 6 max chambers, you know, because I mean, like, you know, the last year of the insane amount of testing and data that we've been collecting, how does the chamber process start?
Well, we'll just take the blank and we'll put it in the lathe.
Let me stop you real quick. How would you select a good blank? What does a good blank look like to you?
I guess, you know, right on the surface is, you know, the first thing I would do is just is inspect the bore. You know, does the bore have a consistent finish?
And this is something that you just kind of eyeball. You just put it up to the light and just look right up.
No, I'll use a bore scope. Yeah, just kind of looked. It looks good. No. Run through with a bore scope. Make sure there's not any, you know, any blems or anything that really stands out. Any pitting. Rough areas, any of that kind of stuff. You know, make sure there's no, like, tearing of the metal. You know, and, of course, it also depends. Are we talking, you know, button? Are we talking, you know, cut rifles? So there's little nuances to both, right? But what we're looking is for an overall consistent bore. Is it consistent in finish? Is it consistent in diameter? And so we have pin gauges. Now, your typical pin gauge sets, like your ZZ minus sets, are in 1 thou increments. And then we step up from there to what are called Deltronic pin gauges, which are in 1/10 thou increments.
So the pin gauges that you're talking about for measuring bore consistency are, again, in 1/10 thou
increments.
Okay. Now, this is where, again, this is what the stuff I wanted to really get into, okay? How important is bore diameter consistency to not only precision but barrel life?
Well, so taking a step back, I think the one blanket approach or the blanket statement that we could apply to precision shooting, regardless of platform or anything, is the key to precision is consistency, absolute consistency in everything. So if we have an absolutely consistent bore diameter for the entire length of that bore, it will be inherently more precise. You know, and I think it's also important to kind of throw in here, you know, so that we're all on the same page. When we're talking about precision, we're talking about the weapon system, right? The rifle, the optic, the ammo, the whole package. When we're talking about, you know, so precision is getting all the bullets to go through the same hole. Accuracy comes from the shooter, right? And so a lot of times those terms are used interchangeably. But, you know, when we're talking specifically about the precision potential of the rifle, we're taking the shooter's input out of that. You know, what is that rifle capable of doing? right? So you could have a very, you know, very precise rifle.
If you were to take the shooter,
inexperienced shooter,
yeah. If you were to take the shooter completely out of the equation and just see what the maximum accuracy potential of the barrel is, or precision potential, precision potential of the barrel, yeah, so, or the weapon system.
Yeah, so precision is putting them all through the same hole. Accuracy is putting the hole where you want it on the target.
Okay.
Fair enough, right?
That's fine.
So a very consistent bore diameter is going to be more conducive to a more precision barrel, right? So then we look at the variables to that. You know, if we, like, best case scenario is an absolutely consistent bore diameter the entire length. Second best case scenario is it starts off looser and ends up tighter. Worst case scenario is it starts off tighter and ends up looser.
And that's the effect that we call tromboning.
Tromboning is the effect that generally happens right at the muzzle by reducing the overall diameter, the outside diameter of the barrel down, making the wall thickness thinner predominantly. Not that it's impossible for it to happen in cut rifled, but it definitely happens in cut in button and hammer forged barrels.
Okay. Now, this is something I want to kind of just go a little bit more in detail in for the folks that are, if you're still listening by now, you're probably really interested in this stuff. All right. So this one's for you. Okay. I think what a lot of folks they can't picture is that as the bullet is traveling down the bore is actually constricting the bullet in flight, right? That's why you cannot drop a bullet through. You should not be able to take a 223 bullet and drop it through a 223 bore. It's not going to just slide on out the other side, right?
Well, so let's address that dimensionally, and we'll just stick with 6mm here. So a typical 6mm blank, right, 6mm bore, will be a 243 groove diameter and a 237 bore or land diameter, which is your bore hole is actually the 237. So a 237 diameter hole is bored through that barrel, and then material is removed to create a groove diameter of 243. So we have a land height of 3 thou. So that 243 diameter bullet, as it is forced down that barrel under pressure, those lands engrave into the jacket of that bullet, right? And then, of course, the helical twist of the rifling is what imparts spin. So having that consistent diameter, you know, like I said a while ago, if it's consistent the whole length, then, hey, it's a nice, smooth ride for that bullet. If it starts off tighter and ends up looser, you know, It's not like it's bouncing around in there by any means, but you know.
But it kind of is, right? So let's say that bullet gets swedged down at like a narrow part of the bore.
Yeah.
And the bore opens up. Remember, this is imperceptible to like the human eye. This isn't something that you're, and this is like Deltronic gauging that you, or air gauging or some of the, right? Okay. So this bullet could, in a bore with an inconsistent diameter, that bullet is getting swedged down just if there's a tighter spot. And if the bore is opening up at all, now does that bullet re-expand to its original size?
No.
Okay.
Depending on where that depending on where that diameter difference would occur, it's possible that the base of the bullet could reobturate under the pressure of the pressure of the propellant to expand to, but just only at the base of the bullet.
Right. So now the rifling is having a little bit less bite on the body of the projectile. Yeah. Okay. But we've seen a lot of times as barrels reach the end of their lifespan, and I've always thought this was really interesting, you'll notice it, the group size and other issues start to happen on lighter projectiles before it happens on heavier projectiles from what we've seen. And my thoughts have always been because there's less surface area on that lighter projectile, meaning typically that it's shorter, right? Because you can't make it wider. Because there's less surface area on there, that the rifling might be getting less bite on that projectile. Is that a reasonable guess as to why we typically see lighter bullets go before heavier bullets? Or what do you think? I might have been wrong in that thinking.
No, I think it's reasonable. I mean, I think it sounds logical. I don't know that
it matters.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, so what you hit upon there, all things being equal, if I've got if diameter is my constraint, right, then to make a bullet heavier, I have to make it longer because I can't make it larger in diameter.
Right.
Right. And now you can change things like more aggressive, less aggressive, boat tail, flat base, things like that to proportionally weight that bullet. But at the end of the day, a 100 grain projectile in, say, 6mm is going to be longer than a 50 grain.
You know?
And so, as subsequently, we're also increasing the bearing surface of the body portion of that bullet in that bore.
Okay. So let's get back to bore consistency for a little bit. Now, on a cut rifle barrel, explain how a cut rifle barrel is made.
Okay.
So, this is fascinating to me.
So, different companies have their own proprietary alloy mixtures and Rockwell hardness requirements and different specs on the metallurgy of the blank itself. But just in the simplest of explanations, you know, we start off with the raw blank. It's a solid steel rod. Okay. And then it goes through a process called gun drilling, which, you know, gun drilling is the term applied to deep hole or long, you know, deep hole boring.
Right. Well, so, I mean, and this is kind of almost like an old world trade, right?
It is. Gun drilling has advanced because of the machinery's advanced, but the process is still basically the same.
Right. You know? For how long now?
Yeah, I don't know. When did muzzle loader start?
Yeah. You know? So this is like an old world kind of, yeah, you know, trade to do it. Yeah.
You know, so a hole is effectively drilled through the entire length of the barrel. Now, granted, it's undersized. Right. And then it goes through a reaming process to ream that hole to a specific size. Okay. So now that we have the hole, like, and we'll just keep picking on 6mm here. So if we're talking about cut rifled, now we have a 2.37 diameter hole, right? Then we go in with what's called single point cut rifling, and it's just a single cutter, you know, and it's on a machine that, so if we want a 7.5 twist, right, we're going to have one 360 degree rotation in 7.5 inches, then the machine basically, you know, cut. And so it takes probably, I don't know, you know, you get different answers from different people, but it takes about 10 times longer to do a cut rifle than it does a button. I'm sorry, 30 times longer to do a cut because you're cutting. So let's say that.
How much material are you removing per pass?
10,000.
So 10,000 material per pass. That's how the rifling's cut into a cut rifle.
Give or take. And I mean, each company has its own proprietary processes, granted. But so, you know, think about it. If we have a six groove, right, six lands and grooves, we've got six grooves to cut. So pass, re-indicate, pass. And so we do that. And then, of course, it's going to be measured along each step of the way. So you end up with six uniform groove depths. Right, because back to the, you know, consistency.
Roughly, depending on that company's technique, roughly 1/10,000.
Yeah, so if we're looking 30 passes per groove, and we have a six groove barrel, you know, that's 180 passes.
Now, typically,
did I do my math right?
No, I think so. Now,
math in public.
Now, typically, cut rifle barrels we see sometimes, or at least historically speaking, right? Because I mean, we're going to get to talk about this in a little bit, but the button rifle technique has advanced quite a bit, and, yes, and people have, I would say, nothing's ever perfect, but like people have gotten button rifle to be pretty damn good.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, typically, the reason why cut rifle barrels historically, I think, or, and we've talked about this, perform a little bit better, or why they at least have the reputation of performing a little bit better, is because the stress relieving, or the stress relief process, and how, because you're moving 1/10,000 at a time, you're not a good.
Well, we're not putting stressors into the barrel.
You're not right? Adding stressors.
That raw material has already been, for lack of a better term, normalized, right? And there's obviously more scientific term and all that for what goes on, but it's already been normalized. So all we're doing is removing material. We're drilling a hole, we're reaming the hole, and we're cutting grooves into it. So we're not putting any stressors into that barrel. So it doesn't require any additional stress relieving processes to occur after rifling.
Now, on a really well made button rifle barrel that is properly stress relieved, can you talk about where do you see the performance difference at that point, cut rifle versus a correctly done button rifle barrel? Is it going to be in the stress relief process?
You know, and unfortunately, that's not something I have a real depth of knowledge about. But you know, what I can, you know, or what I do know about this is, so when in the button rifling process, okay, you're starting off with essentially the same raw material that's normalized, right? It gets drilled, it gets reamed, but then a button is pulled through it hydraulically, and it is forging or forming the lands and grooves. So in that process, we are now generating different densities, you know, in that barrel. So we're putting stressors into it. So, you know, one argument and one side of it that I've heard, which, you know, I'm not saying I agree or disagree with either one, but you know, one approach is okay. Well, let's run it through some heat, heat treat it again. Let's run it through some thermal cycling. Let's cryogenically treat it. You know, something in an attempt to try to renormalize that. But the fact of the matter is you've now changed the densities in there. So, you know, does it truly have a significant benefit or does it not? The other approach is, you know, all that work was put into that raw blank originally to create the certain properties that it has to meet the specs that the barrel manufacturer wanted it to have. By reheat treating that barrel, now you might be removing some of those beneficial properties that were put into it originally.
Well, I was saying one thing we've seen talking to different barrel manufacturers over the years is that you're talking about gun drilling and then reaming. Not everybody reams. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of the cheap blanks on the market are just gun drilled. Yeah. They don't even ream them.
Yeah.
And
that's a huge that is a huge deal.
Yeah. Yeah, and we see that, you know, and we've seen that looking in with Borescope. You can see the remnants of that spiral, you know, of the drilling process leaving.
Yeah, if you're buying a $60-$70 barrel, it probably wasn't reamed. Yeah, it's probably just gun drilled and that was it.
Okay.
Just ran with it.
since you brought this up and we broached the subject of us having talked to multiple barrel manufacturers over the years, this is one of my favorite Sons of Liberty topics to read about on Reddit. Okay. From folks that so let me think of a way to phrase this question. Do barrel OEMs have different grades of barrels? Like, if you were to call OEM X and they were to offer you a menu option, is there a 100 series, 200 series, 300 series, 400 series? Is this a thing?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Now, what is the difference, in your opinion, between a 400 series and, say, a 100 series? What is the difference in that?
From my understanding, it's the quality of the finished ore.
Now, granted, this varies from OEM to OEM, sure. And not this doesn't apply to all of them, but as an example, like, if you happen to know the OEM of a barrel, does that tell you everything, or does that maybe tell you 10% of the amount of information that you would have to know about that barrel?
I would say less than 10%.
Knowing the OEM would tell you, in your opinion, less than 10% about what the finished product that the consumer gets in their fucking hand.
Absolutely. Hey, okay. You know, look at all the variables. I mean, you know, you can take a
let's
raw
talk about
blank.
The variables. Yeah, that's good.
You can take a raw rifled blank from whatever company, right? It still has to go through several processes to become a finished barrel. And all of those have effects on the quality of the finished product.
So, like, let's just say, like, a 100 series or a 400 series. Like, from your understanding of at least some of the OEMs we've jointly spoken to, what is the difference between the 400 and the 100%?
The quality, you know, of the finished bore. The tolerance quality, the finish quality.
Now
how much tooling marks remain, how much, you know.
Now, if you're calling up a company and you're about to order 10,000 barrels, how much input do you have when you're dictating the specs of the barrel to that OEM who's expected to make it for you, to your print, to your specs? What are you asking for?
On the raw blank or on a finished, completed barrel?
I mean, from the time this guy picks up the fucking phone.
You can, you know, specify the type of rifling, the rifling the number of lands and grooves, the rifling profile, what the dimensional tolerances are, you know, what dimension, what your target dimension is and what the plus minus tolerance of that is on the initial bore and land, you know, land, bore and groove diameter. You know, what material you want it made out of. You know, do you want it out of stainless? You want it out of chrome moly? You want it out of, you know, ordnance grade steel, you know? So all those specs on the initial raw blank, and then from that point, you know, and then from that point forward, you know, on the finished, you know, what profile do you want? What threads do you want? What thread class are you requiring? You know, is it a 2A? Is it a 3A? You know, do you want 5/8-24 threads on a 223 barrel?
Hey, I know. I know a guy. Okay, so
is that a pausing point?
No. So okay, so like let's back up just a hair. So when we're talking about tolerance of bore, now there are some people that look at SAMI specs, and when they say that you know that barrel was made to SAMI specs. Now SAMI obviously has something to do with the chamber dimensions, right?
Yeah. Well, and going back to backing up a step, the key to precision is consistency.
Right.
So the larger a tolerance range that I allow any entity to have in how they produce the final product.
And you can dictate this tolerance range, exactly. Right? Yeah, when you're, when you, hey, Bob, I need 10,000 fucking barrels. I'm going to write you a seven-figure check. You're going to make it this way.
Yeah.
And this is the tolerances that we expect, or you're getting a return label and you're not getting a Christmas card this year.
Well, but also, you know, understand, too, that that's what adds cost to it as well. You know, if you say that I can have a tolerance range of 2,000, well, I can hit that a lot easier and a lot faster and produce more in the same time frame than if I can only have a tolerance range of 1,000, 1/10,000. That's going to take a lot more time, you know. So like anything, you want more performance, it comes at a price. And it doesn't necessarily only come at a price just monetarily, but it can also, if you're seeking the ultimate precision, it can come at a cost of reliability.
Yeah, that's something a lot of people don't realize. I mean, they look at barrels and like, oh, they're all long, you know, it's long, black, and hard, and it's the same length, and it's got the same thing. But, I mean, there's a lot that goes into it. You know, the quality of the blank, you know, we're talking about button rifling, and one big thing is if you've got soft spots in it, it's going to dig in more. You know, you're going to get that variation. You know what I mean? Like I said, the tolerancing, you know, the quality control, you know, was it reamed? Was it honed? You know, all those different steps. Was it lapped?
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot more. You know, there's a big difference between a $200 barrel and a $500 barrel. Well, people aren't just making shit up. Shouldn't be making shit up.
Exactly. And that's the part that for the most part, the end consumer's never going to fully, they're not going to be able to see those things. And it takes very specialized toolage and tooling and knowledge and experience to even be able to measure things to that level.
So
like, to test for it.
So let's take a 6mm barrel, for example, right? Because we've been doing a lot of work on Macs and stuff, right? Sammy tolerance or Sammy spec, which is designed for safety, not performance, right? Yes. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, safety and operational reliability.
Safety and operational reliability is where SAMI tolerances come from, right? Now, the SAMI tolerances, would you say, are pretty forgiving?
Yeah, yes.
Okay. So what would the, like, what are the SAMI tolerances? I don't know if you know off the top of your head for a 6mm, do you know?
I could be wrong, but I think the tolerance range on a 6mm as far as the bore diameter goes up to, like, 2.38 or 2.39, okay. 2,000 over. So if it's supposed to be 2.37, I think it's a 2,000 over. But don't quote me on that.
Sure. But I guess what I'm asking is, though, is that if you were designing a barrel specifically for precision, or you were selecting a blank specifically for precision, what would your tolerance range be?
I'd want it as close to 2.37 as possible.
So you're saying 2,000 would not be optimal?
No. 2.10,000.
2.10,000, oh, okay.
You know, if they were that plus or minus 2.10,000, yeah.
Okay.
You know, and, you know, we talk about how far down the rabbit hole you want to get. You know, if I were going to take it to the nth degree, I'd actually determine what bullet I was going to use and measure those bullets and see what the consistency of those are. You know, because some bullet manufacturers, their diameter is slightly smaller, you know. So,
I was gonna say, I had a technical question. Would you're saying like 2.38 is, you know, SAMI spec? It would 2.38 the whole way be better than 2.37, 2.38, 2.38?
Well, yeah, I mean, because you know, consistent would it be inherently more conducive to precision? Yes, you know.
Now, no, it's like it gets
consistently
you.
Consistently not right is better than right wrong down the length of the barrel.
So, you know, but if the diameter of the bullets, you know, of a 6mm bullet is 243, right? That bullet is probably going to have a much nicer ride in a 237, 243 bore than it would do in a 239, 245 bore.
We like our bores tight.
All right. We're keeping it in the highest traditions of sons. We have to slip in something long, black, and hard. All right.
So, San Diego.
Okay. Now, this is good stuff. On that, going back to the bore consistency. Now, what we have seen through experimenting with many, many different blanks and processes and trying a lot of different stuff, I know there's a lot of companies that advertise like hand lapped barrels and they're very big about the lapping process and stuff like that, which, by the way, I think if done right, there is something to be said for
absolutely lapping. So in a cut rifle barrel, predominantly cut rifle barrel, if that are hand lapped and hand lapped properly,
right,
what you're doing effectively is eliminating the need for barrel break-in.
Yes. Now, because, you know, because every imperfection in burr and everything else has been lapped out.
Yeah. Now, there's a lot of camps on that topic. You know, that's opened up a whole can of worms. But, but you know, you're not going to, through shooting rounds through it, you're not going to remove tooling marks and imperfections. I mean, you're putting a copper jacket against a stainless or chrome moly bore, which is, you know, inherently softer. The copper's inherently softer, right? Now, the analogy that I use a lot, like we talk about typically in a cut rifle barrel, somewhere on average, you know, between 100 and 200 rounds, you know, if everything remains the same, you're shooting the same load, you will a lot of times, more often than not, see a slight speed up in velocity.
I've seen that. I mean, almost predictable. I mean, like 200-300 rounds, that thing's kind of still speeding up, then it plateaus to some degree. Yeah,
and so kind of the best way that I've found to explain that is, you know, you ever gone to a restaurant that had like a brass or a bronze door handle, right?
Right.
And the part where everybody grabs it is polished, and the rest of it's still tarnished, right?
Right.
But we all know that the bronze or brass is inherently harder than our skin is, but it's through repeated application that it has burnished. Is the term I like to apply, whether it's technically accurate or not. But so what it's doing is through repeated application of that bullet down that bore, round after round after round, you're slightly burnishing that surface, and you're smoothing out the ride somewhat.
Right. And so what's interesting, like getting away from the precision a little bit, we do know that even companies that are producing like fighting barrels or, you know, endurance barrels, chrome moly kind of stuff, right? There are places that talk about, you know, hand lap finished barrels. And I believe that there is a benefit if it's done right.
Correct.
Now, if it's done wrong and you're lapping the life out of that barrel, can you explain what that looks like?
Well, yeah. If you're taking it beyond, you know, if you're trying to hit a certain dimensional tolerance and then through the hand lapping process, for whatever reason, it's done improperly, then you're basically removing life out of that barrel and conceivably making it less precise.
I had a long talk with one of our barrel OEMs that does some of our precision barrels, and he was telling me he had done some consulting work for another barrel plant, and they did a lot of hand lapping, but they were doing it to bring it back into spec. You know, their chambers were little out of consideration, you know, they weren't quite lined up to the bore. Everything was a little off, and they had like some really amazing hand lapping guides, and they would actually lap them back into spec.
Yeah.
And his, you know, he was doing some consulting for him, and he's like, why don't you just do it right in the first place? It's a lot cheaper.
Yeah. Well, and there's some pictures floating around, you know, where end users have taken, you know, a product like JB bore paste on a brush, you know, and lap the hell out of that barrel, and you look at the bore scope and you see striations through, you know, longitudinally through the length of that bore where they've literally removed metal, you know.
Would you suggest that some, like, you know, if you're a casual shooter and you're home, you know, bored one day, is this something you should do?
No. No. I fall into the camp that more people do more damage over cleaning their barrels than if they would just shoot the thing and leave it alone. I mean, like, if you need to go in and clean the chamber every once in a while, fine.
There should
but
be
leave
a,
the
there
bore
a,
alone.
There should be a test before someone's allowed to buy a bore scope.
Yeah.
So, well, I'm glad you brought that up. That's going to be the next question I was going to ask. But I teach this in my armorer's class that I have. I think it's easier to clean a gun to death than it is to shoot a gun to
Absolutely.
Death.
Absolutely.
And I mean, if you look at some of the stuff people do, putting steel brushes on drills and stuff like that, you know, going in and out. Well,
some of the most damage occurs, my opinion, is when they have a poor quality, especially if it's a multi-section cleaning rod, and there's any diameter difference between those sections, and they're running through there, and let's say that little step is stepping up to a larger diameter going into the bore, and first off, you should never clean from the muzzle end.
Right.
The only exception to that being like a lever action.
Right.
But always clean from the chamber end. But think about where that step up is, you know, from your neck into the throat and the throat up the lead and the lead up onto the land. And now you have this, you know, stainless steel or metal rod, and you're, you know, jamming that into that, and you're literally either leaving material off that rod or removing material out of the barrel. You just did irreversible damage to that bore. If you had just left it alone.
And I talk to a lot of my friends that are really good, talented, just badass shooters, but, you know, but they don't always, you know, don't on the maintenance side of things. And it frustrates me whenever they tell me, I get a call, hey man, you know, I clean my barrel and my group size is different, or like there's been a, like that clean bore, you know, zero, or that clean bore group versus, like, you know, like, you want a little copper fouling in that thing, don't you?
Yeah, and I think a couple of approaches.
Do you strip copper out of your precision barrels? No.
I don't even clean them. The only thing on my PRS bolt guns, like for several years now, I've shot a 6XC like in 2 days and a 223 in club matches, is, you know, somewhere around the 900 round mark, I'll go in and remove the carbon ring, right, at the end of the neck. And then again, somewhere around the 1500 round mark, and then somewhere around 2 to 2200 rounds, I pull the barrel off. So I don't actually clean the bore ever.
Kyle brought up a really interesting point.
But that's just me.
Yeah, no. I think it's most people in the competition circuit.
That's the joke of competition. It's like people ask me and Lloyd, so how often do you clean it? I'm like, why would I clean it?
Yeah,
it's working.
Yeah. You're taking all the good stuff out. Why would you do that?
Well, and so there again, this is just my theory on this. But, you know, when I get asked about you know, whether stripping the copper out, things like that, I like to use a lot of analogies in this, but if you're shooting a mass produced fire, like say you go buy a 700 SPS off the shelf at Academy, right? And it's not shooting well. I think that sometimes you could maybe create an improvement by stripping the bore, shoot around, carbon clean, shoot around, carbon clean, shoot around. And the goal here is to put copper on top of copper on top of copper. And so what I kind of equate it to is, you know, if you've got a potholed up road that creates a rough ride and the crew comes in and fills all the potholes and now it's smoothed out the ride, why would you want to go in and pull all the filling out of the potholes again?
Kind of right? Like a chrome line barrel.
Just carbon clean, just carbon clean only, right? If you're going to clean, but leave the copper in there. A lot of times that can sometimes make an improvement. Now, if it's a, you know, top of the line premium cut rival hand lap barrel, you know, you're not going to make any improvement by doing anything to it, in my opinion.
Kyle had brought up something I thought was interesting, and this was something that was kind of a shock to me. Like, I over the last year, I'll be honest, I've learned a lot more about specific aspect, which is everybody should remain a constant student. You're a constant student. I talked to Chad Albert from School of the American Rifle, and that guy, I think you've taken his class.
I was on the phone with him for an hour earlier this week, and I mean, you know, we covered a lot of things, and yeah, he is a tremendous resource.
But that guy learns stuff daily, so I don't pretend to have all the answers. I certainly don't. I'll tell you one of the things I thought was amazing, though, was you and I had a project that we were on an insanely tight time crunch for, to where like we didn't have time to do some of the things we normally would, right? And so we're going through blanks and we're going through barrels and we're trying to hand pick the best of the best, at least to which to start the data collection and testing. Yes. Yeah. And we used Deltronic gauges, we used bore scopes, we used whatever. In your opinion, if all you have at your disposal is a fucking borescope and you were to go in there, do you think you can say how accurate is your guess about the inherent accuracy or precision, I suppose, of that barrel based upon a borescope inspection alone?
Before or after that?
Before or after our travels through?
Before it was much higher. After it's much, much lower.
Well, that's something I've seen interesting. Like, so I notice I'll look at a lot of conversations online and I look at things, and somebody without having ever fired a round through a barrel will get the barrel and run a borescope through it and then start making, you know, determinations, calling an OEM, calling a factory, calling whatever, wanting there to be some kind of corrective action. And I tell people, go shoot. Like, first of all, the target doesn't lie.
Believe the bullet.
Believe the bullet, right. So go shoot first, because I see people using bore scopes sometimes to try to gain some. And I got to tell you, it's a lot less revealing than you ever would imagine.
In that particular
project,
thank you. I picked out based visually on the bore scope inspection, the two that I believe to be the prettiest, let's call it, right? The least amount of imperfections, the most consistent finish quality, et cetera, in the bore. Those two did not shoot the best.
They did not.
you'd be really surprised how many times we have, like, quality, you know, guys will reach out to the info email and be like, I ran a bore scope through it, it looks like shit. And they're like, have you shot it? No. And then they go shoot it and like, yeah, it's shooting like, you know,
on some of the best barrel I've ever shot.
Yeah, it's shooting 3/4 minute groups. I'm like, Are you still want to send it back? Like,
nah, I mean, you know, if you're inspecting with a bore scope and it's supposed to have four lands and grooves, it only has three, then you might you might have a claim. But I mean, just trying
I think if you see like severe pitting or sure. rust, or if you yeah. start seeing something like, you know, potholes or something, I mean, you know, that or it's missing a gas port, right? Like, I mean, you know, of course. I'm just saying, I was surprised at how little true information you glean from that, you know?
Just from a visual inspection, yeah.
Just from a visual inspection. I was surprised, too, because, you know, Sons Liberty, for the entire history of our company from day one, we've offered free barrel replacement. If you shot a barrel out, we would replace it. I got to tell you, in the 10 years we've been in business, we have replaced very few. There's been, like, a machine gun rental range. I think some of these larger training academies that their instructors shoot daily for a living for years, and there's... Like, we've replaced some of those. But if you look at some of the barrels that we've replaced, what I found interesting is, like, I think it'd be a smooth bore. Like, up until, like, the last inch of barrel was still some rifling. And, like, the thing was grouping a hell of a lot better than you would necessarily expect it to.
Yeah.
You know, which... let me ask you, whenever you see keyholing, where does that stuff come from?
I mean, generally, it's because the bullet is hitting something upon exiting the muzzle. You know, misalignment of a muzzle device or can, you know, it can be a truly, truly shot out, a bore.
I mean, like but what does that bore look like? I mean, would you guess if you see a bullet keyhole?
I would, my guess would be that you would literally find very little remains of any kinds of lands in that barrel. You know, right. It'd be worn almost to the point of being smooth throughout the length of it.
Is that hard to do?
It would take a lot of rounds.
Yeah, I think the one that the machine gun rental range that sent one back a few years ago that it was keyholing, I think they had put like 60,000-70,000 rounds through it. Well, it wouldn't group for shit, but it took a long time for that son of a bitch to actually keyhole.
I think it was closer like to 100,000.
It was a lot.
But I know there that. Again, one of the things that we haven't yet in this conversation really, really hit upon is what is your expectation of precision? You know what I mean?
Ooh.
Because that's getting yeah, that's getting into the whole thing. I mean, because
that's a really fantastic question.
You know, if I'm a bench rest shooter, if I'm a F class shooter, if I'm a PRS shooter, if I'm an ELR shooter, if I'm a deer hunter, you know, all the way to if my accuracy expectation is minute of man. You know, these are all different requirements. You know, so when you claim that your barrel's not precise anymore, well, what's that based on? You know?
Okay, so let's work it from the top to the bottom, I suppose. If you're an F class or if you're a bench rest shooter, what does that look like to that guy?
Maybe? So obviously, from a bench, you know, for the bench rest shooter, their goal is literally to put a hole in a hole in a hole, period.
Okay.
Right. So some of the things that for example might have some bearing on that is twist rate, right? So in bench rest, you know, one of the approaches is they don't want any more twist in that barrel than is absolutely necessary to stabilize that bullet to the required target distance. So if you were building a 100-yard or 200 or 600-yard bench rest gun, for example, the reason they don't want any more twist than necessary is because if there is any eccentricity in the weight of that bullet, right, any, you know, difference in density jacket wall thickness.
Exacerbates it, yeah.
So the faster you spin that bullet, the more wobble that bullet will have. And so if literally the goal is to put a hole in a hole and you're measuring down to the 10,000ths of an inch for group size to determine who won, if a bullet goes in wobbling, it's going to create a bigger hole. What, right? So we're talking extreme, one extreme end of the spectrum, right? So
I've done matches, but that's not, like, that bench press is never something I've gotten into. Like, sure. What would, like, on a 6-millimeter, like, your... The 6 mil you're running, what twist rate would you use on something like that? Like,
currently, I'm running an 8. We're also running 7.5. I've checked both. There's negligible difference in the drag value that it produces.
So for a bench rest rifle?
No, he said that I'm running the 6 mil.
I'm talking about for like an F class. So like, what would they run? Like, because 8's not much different than what we run on a 6 max.
Guys that are shooting like 6. I'm trying to go from memory. Guys that are shooting like 6 PPCs, I think, are running like 1 in 13, 1 in 14, 1 in 15 twists.
That's a pretty slow twist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to, if there's sectional density or if there's jacket thing.
Well, but think about this. You know, the reason we spin the bullet is to create stability in flight. Well, if I'm only shooting to 100 yards,
yeah, not as concerned.
You know what I mean? And so let's go to the other end of that spectrum and let's look at the ELR competitor, right? They don't want to miss a target because the bullet lost stability in flight because it didn't start off spinning fast enough. And so as over the flight of that bullet, and you have spin rate degradation, right? So we're going to start off much faster. So that bullet carries and maintains that stability much further out.
I'm surprised these guys aren't shooting those Franklin Armory guns. They're like, what, 1 in 3?
Yeah.
Well, the straight ones.
Yeah. I actually got to spend a couple days behind Kevin Brittingham's 8.6.
Oh, yeah. That's a real slow twist.
Well, no, it's fat. It's 1 in 3.
Oh, so, fast, yeah. Excuse me.
Yeah, so it's got a 1 in 3 twist. And what's amazing, I mean, it's repeatable. I mean, you can obviously calculate it for it with your ballistic solution. But, I mean, that the spin drift on that is extreme.
Yeah, I mean, they're running 1 in 3, 1 in 4 twists on those.
Yeah, I mean, but it's repeatable. So, I mean, like, you calculate it. It's not like you have to guess every time or something. But I'm saying, like, the calculation for that spin drift is
higher
than...
We go back, okay, so one end of this is you can't overstabilize a bullet.
I don't. Yeah. Well, if you talk to like Chase Stroud and those ELR guys, the faster they can spin that bullet, the
barrel. You can't overstabilize a bullet
because it's going to remain stable even past subsonic, as it's going transonic. Yeah. It responds to dope because the faster it's spinning, the more stable.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, in that specific example with Chase, you know, they're predominantly shooting lathe turned copper solid bullets, right. So you don't have that cup and core construction, so you're not worried about centrifugal force separating that core from that jacket and that bullet, you know, coming apart.
So you can really crank that thing, huh?
Yeah, and so you know, bullet bonding technology, construction of bullets, all of that has improved tremendously over the years. That, you know, used to, like, I remember when I first started hand loading, I was running 220 Swift, pushing some, even at that time, ancient, you know, whatever 50 grain bullets or 45 grain bullets, and I'm at the range and I'm shooting and I'm like, there's no hole appearing in the target. This old guy comes over, he goes, hey, get everything lined up and look over the bore and pull the trigger. And I'm like, why? He goes, just trust me. And about 3 feet ahead, there's this gray cloud. So I was spinning it so fast, too high a velocity, creating too much spin.
You're just vaporizing that bullet. So we're talking about like the...
So if you want to know what your RPM, you want to go nerd on this, you want to know what your bullet RPM on exit is take muzzle velocity times 720 divided by spin, divided by twist rate. So if you're running like an 8-twist barrel, at 3,000 feet a second, do 3,000 times 720 divided by 8, and that'll tell you what your exit RPMs of that bullet are. So on that note, just another nerd fact, nothing...
That's what he wrote that
nothing
down.
Nothing that exists...
Yes.
Think about this. Nothing that exists spins as fast as a bullet.
Wow. Really?
Think about it.
That makes sense. I mean, what is that? Just so folks can understand... You know, what is the typical RPM on a rifle cartridge?
Let's do the math. What are we going to pick?
58 grain 6 max. You know, we're going 3,700 feet per second.
About 3,500 feet per second.
Let's apply a more conventional approach to this. Let's go a masses example. Let's say that we have a 308 going 2,600 feet a second. Reasonable?
Yes.
Right? Times 720, and we're going to divide that by, conventionally, is a 10-twist barrel on that, right? So 187,200 RPM.
So the rotation of that 308 is 187,200 RPM.
Now, conversely, if I'm shooting, say, a 55-grain bullet out of a 7.5-twist that's doing, let's just say, 3,500 feet a second times 720 divided by 7.5, that's 336,000 RPM.
That's fucking fast.
That's why I said nothing spins as fast as a bullet.
Well, and there you have it.
So,
yeah, tell your math teacher you apologize.
So if you should have paid
attention.
Weaponized math.
Yeah, if you slow the twist rate down a little bit, it's still spinning pretty damn fast.
Oh, yeah.
So going back, we were talking about the accuracy expectations and stuff. So if you're a bench press shooter, you know, even if the bullet is coming in with a slight wobble, making a larger hole, that could be the difference between like first and fifth place or something, right?
Exactly.
Or first and last place for that matter. Okay. But are we looking at are you looking at standard deviation in muzzle velocity? Are you looking at extreme spread? Like those guys aren't necessarily, is it just group size that they're looking for? Or would they DQ a barrel once per se the velocity is getting to a point that's unaccessible? Or would that manifest on the target?
As a bench rest shooter, they would be based on group size opening up.
Group size opening up.
Um, you know, maybe it's kind of a blanket statement, but, you know, across the board, bench press shooters are concerned about group size, not about velocity extreme spread.
Okay.
Okay. As a ELR shooter, you're concerned about velocity extreme spread. And then something else that, not go off too much on a tangent, but it applies to that, is we now have easily field deployable equipment that allows us to measure time of flight and actually measure what the BC for each bullet's flight is.
And this stuff's tied to the atomic clock, right? I mean, is it, I mean, aren't some of them?
The last generation of equipment was, the current generation isn't. They were able to make improvements in that to where now the radio, they sync. So, but yes, the former version used a GPS system, you know, because all the GPS system is tied into the atomic clock there in what, Colorado Springs, I think. So, anyway. But so we, you know,
the
so
time
just
of
like,
flight.
Yeah, so just like we have velocity extreme spread for, you know, say we shoot a 10-shot, you know, string of 10 shots, and we chronograph that, and we have our fastest and our slowest, and we have our average, we have our SD. We have that with BC, too. So BC is not an absolute. You know, what it says on the box is generally a based on all conventional parameters, right?
I don't think a lot of people understand
conventional barrel length, and most of that is done typically at a 200-yard range.
Yeah, I don't think most end users understand that BC is not a static number.
Yeah. You know, in a simple explanation, you know, to figure out what our come up is, and, you know, we're going to leave out atmospheric variables and all that, but just the core things are we need a velocity, a range, and a BC. So we're going to pretend like velocity and range are absolutes, and BC is a best guess, and we use that to calculate time of flight, and then we can figure the effect of gravity on the bullet, how much it's going to drop. So we now have the ability to actually easily, I mean, the technology's been around for a long time, but it is now easily field deployable to set up to measure time of flight.
Now, I think like PRS shooting is going to be maybe as close to applicable for, you know, people in a DM or
absolutely,
you know, like a designated marksman role or like a recce guy,
yeah,
or something. So if you were to take the PRS quantified performance type of matches, that is going to most closely replicate, like, you know, because if we're building weapons for somebody that's going to deploy this like for a life or death situation, those matches and that style of shooting is going to be a little bit closer, obviously, than bench rest.
Oh, absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, okay. Absolutely.
So for a recce gun or a DM rifle that you need to make a hostage rescue kind of shot, or you need to make one of these, you know, a true life or death kind of shot, what is an accuracy expectation of a deployable rifle like that? That is a deployable precision rifle that, I mean, it needs to meet at least this standard in order for it to achieve what you need it to achieve with a high degree of predictability.
Provided that it is an accomplished, capable shooter, mm-hmm. It is a quality load mm-hmm. of the ammo, then I believe the weapon system should be able to consistently deliver MOA.
Now, whenever... Now. Hold on. This is where you want to pay attention. When you say a one MOA group, are you talking about like an anomalous cherry-picked three-round group?
Not the wallet group. So if we want to achieve 95% statistical probability of what a group size is for a given weapon system, you know, assuming that we change no variables, we would need to shoot 35 five-shot groups.
Okay.
To really come up with a true average of what, you know, with 95% statistical probability, what the true average of that rifle system is.
So you're saying after 35 five-round groups, taking that average, when you say one MOA, that's what you're talking
about?
Yeah. Okay, I just want to make sure, because I hear a lot of people talk about, my rifle shoots a half minute, because they measured some anomalous three-round group that, you know.
Yeah.
Okay, that is not what you're talking about.
No.
So here's – okay, so let's get into realistic accuracy expectations, which is what led us down this particular rabbit hole. When people talk about – whenever I – and I talk about this in class. I've talked about this on another podcast. I said if you have a true one-minute rifle, I think that it will accomplish anything you reasonably need it to do, including the hostage rescue shot, including the, you know, deployable kind of, you know, recce precision rifle role. But when I'm saying it's a true one-minute rifle, you're talking, you know, we're talking about the average group size of 35 five-shot groups. Okay.
Is a reasonable standard to apply to that, yes.
Right. And if you're shooting 10-shot groups and your rifle is 1 minute, that has told you something about that rifle.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely.
And so, the shooter.
And well, and the shooter, the load, the system, yeah. the optic,
because, the mount. I mean, well, we were talking about PRS one time, and we were talking discussing the differences between, because I was hung up on MOA. And he said the difference between the bigger, the thing you need to worry about is ES, because downrange, half MOA and one MOA don't matter as much as ES, because ES, your extreme spread, if you don't know.
Velocity extreme spread, yes.
Velocity extreme spread matters more and will actually take you off the target. More than your difference between a half MOA gun and a one MOA gun. So as long as you have a one MOA gun, you're plenty fine.
Yeah.
But once you start to venture into ammo where your extreme spread or, you know, all the variables, people don't consider the variables as much as they should when they're talking about, well, I want a gun that does this. Okay, well, number one, why? And are you capable of said degree of precision? Because if you as a shooter are only capable of one MOA on your best day when the stars have aligned and, you know, your wife was nice to you that morning and all the other things, then no offense, but maybe you're just not a one MOA shooter. It's not a knock, but, you know, and for that matter, the barrel maker, was he having a good day that day? You know, was it Friday? Was it the end of the life of that machine? What is all the other things? There's so many things. Anyway, but the difference between a half MOA and a one MOA barrel, it's not that when you're talking about at distance, especially.
And that's what you got to do. You have to be brutally honest with yourself in this assessment is what can you consistently deliver, right? And if people ask me, I say I can consistently deliver with any of my PRS comp guns, one MOA. I'm like, oh, I figured it'd be better than that. I'm like, no, that's what I can consistently do. A lot of times it may be half or less. Some days I'm not feeling it, it may be one and a half, you know. But what can I consistently deliver, right? And also when like in that scenario when I'm talking about that, I'm talking about 10-shot groups, not a 3-shot group.
Right.
A 10-shot group.
And the reason I bring this up, number one, you'd asked about a reasonable accuracy expectation, you know, or realistic, not reasonable, realistic expectation. One of the things that's frustrating that I see is even, you know, amongst my fellow manufacturers and stuff like that, is whenever there are claims of sub-minute accuracy guarantee. Now, I believe, I mean, the six max barrels that we're producing, I would be very surprised, and I would expect a sub-minute, mm-hmm. a true sub-minute group.
Yeah, the one we tested the other day, I mean, the one you tested was shooting what?
Yeah, shooting great.
Shooting close to half minute, yeah.
But the thing is, though, again, like... When I think the term sub minute gets thrown around a lot without people understanding what that actually means to somebody who does this professionally, and then, you know, again, like getting that anomalous 3-shot group out of your deer rifle.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that's the same thing we run into with everything, you know, talking about anything we talk about in our industry is like the sample size of one. Be like, I shot a half minute group and one time, and the other 34 were a minute and a half. You know, it's like we get a lot of that. I mean, like, oh, you know, I bought this product and it worked great, or it didn't work, or, you know, like, I bought this piece of shit gun and it works amazing. I was like, yeah, it's good for you, you know, but the other 400 didn't.
Right. The anecdotal shit and the sample size of one, that is one of the most challenging things we have to deal with. Like, right now, like, our production barrels for our SPR barrels, on a production level, meaning, like, we're sending these out in batches of, like, several hundred, to get the performance that we're getting, I gotta tell you, is challenging.
It is
not easy to do that.
And to interject something here, like the other day, one of the barrels that I was testing, unrelated, but I shot 10 5-shot groups, 4 different loads. The overall average was like 0.968. So based on that result, that is a sub MOA.
Oh, yeah.
Now,
over 4 different loads.
4 different loads. So
10 groups per load. Or, sorry, yeah, 10 groups per load? Or was it 5?
Well, it was, well, however the math works. Don't ask me to math right now. No, but you know, the point is some of those loads were a higher precision load than the others, you know, different bullets, et cetera. So, you know, one of them just being a straight up hunting round, right, was the larger group size. So you can't base your assessment. I mean, if you're going to make a hard line, hey, I'm going to claim this barrel is not MOA or better. Well, how many rounds are through that barrel? How many different loads have you shot through it? You know? Yeah. Well, I just went down and I bought a box of Monarch.
There's a lot of really high-end loads. We see that a lot in the law enforcement government side of the world. There's a lot of the really high-end load, man-killing loads are not accurate at all. Like, they're really good at putting things down, like hunting loads. Hunting loads, same thing. A lot of your soft-tip loads and stuff like that are really expand well. They're good at what they do, but they're two-minute loads usually. They're not that accurate.
Well, exactly. And we were talking about qualifying precision. You know, like, as a deer hunter, and let's say predominantly like hill country, and my typical range is going to be 60 to 100 yards, if I can literally keep three rounds on a paper plate at 100 yards, I have achieved the precision level I need to be able to take down a deer in the hill country.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? So, you know, it's orienting your components to your intended task as well.
So one of the things I wanted to cover to you while we're here, there's an interesting conversation that I see online, and a lot of people in our industry have pretty much accepted this kind of stuff as doctrine, as if this is an absolute truth. And that is, like, when you look at hammer forged like 4150 chromoly barrels versus button rifles, things like that. Now, I thought this was a really interesting thing, and I see it over and over and over again. One of my favorite rifle companies, and I talk about our competitors all the time, is there's a lot of rifle companies that I have a lot of respect for because they're true performance brands. And one of those brands is LMT. LMT, people know the OEM are heavy gun 308 BCG, stuff like that. I mean, I'm very transparent about that. But LMT does not use a hammer forged barrel. They use a stress relief cryogenic treated, 4150 barrel chrome line, and that is it. But you'd be surprised how many people on the internet would assume that an LMT barrel is a hammer forged barrel. And the reason being is because they associate cold hammer forge with quality. They know that LMT is a quality manufacturer, and they arbitrarily put those two things together and make the assumption, because any gun company that good must use a hammer forged barrel. And the reason why I bring this up is because this is a conversation I've had for years and years and years with, customers and fans and critics and everybody else. If I were to tell you, or I should say, if all you know about a barrel is that it is cold hammer forged, can you make any kind of reasonable prediction on barrel life or accuracy? If the only information you have is that it's a cold hammer forged barrel, how much of the equation does that tell you?
Very little.
Very, very little.
Is the crown, is the crown concentric? Is it a burr? Is it a clean cut crown? Is the chamber concentric to the bore? Or was it cut crooked? Was it out of spec?
How about bore diameter?
Is the bore diameter consistent? Okay. I mean,
how about if half the life's been lapped out of it at the factory? Or how about the lining that goes into it? Or how about the, get into the armorer's side. Like, what would you rather have what is the gas port size? What is blah, 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 whatever.
And there's some lower end brands. I mean, like, Ruger uses a cold hammer forge 4140 barrel. I mean, it's not even.
Yeah.
Right. So this has been one of those things. And by the way, we have done a lot of destructive testing to stuff. If you guys have followed us for any length of time, you see some of the absolutely stupid shit we've done to guns in the name of science, and because our boys like to fuck around and we have fun doing it, right? One of the most surprising things to me, because I accepted this as doctrine, and I accepted this as, like, just a truth, that the lifespan on hammer-forged barrels would be longer, measurably longer, or significantly longer than that of, like, a well-made button-rifled 4150 barrel. And after having done enough destructive shit to guns, meaning, like, destructive firing schedules where you're getting guns so hot that the actual color of the material is changing, you're turning stuff white, you're melting gas tubes, you're doing some really... I have honestly found that the data overlaps. There's an overlapping data. Now, if you were to take a stainless steel barrel and you were to shoot it to that firing schedule, and then, like, a 4150 chrome moly barrel, the plot points on that are separate on the graph. Like, there's an actual separation of the plot points for where that would be. When you do it, whenever the substrate material is the same, though, regardless of the construction method or the process in which the barrel was made, you see some interesting overlap. So, don't get me wrong, we are releasing for the first time, the Sons of Liberty Cold Hammer Forge barrel in our new V2 profile. We are releasing a Hammer Forge barrel in our V2 profile. Kyle, you actually have one here.
This is a button rifled one, not a Cold Hammer Forge.
But the profile's the same.
Yeah, this is the V2 profile in the 5.56. You can say you can see we made it thicker towards the chamber in to make it hold up better to full auto fire and higher schedule rates of fire. And took some weight out in the front. It's slightly heavier than our previous government profile barrels, but maybe 5%. Yeah, it's slightly heavier, but not a lot.
I wouldn't say 5%. it's less than that, man. It's not quite
It's damn
that.
Near the same weight, yeah.
It's damn near the same weight, and the weight has been distributed more towards the rear of the gun. And what we wanted to do was make the front of the gun, because that's where you know, when it comes to the weight distribution of the rifle, that's typically where you're hanging suppressors off. That's where your enablers go. That's where your lights and lasers and everything are up front. So, you know, bringing that weight towards the receiver side, it's helping to balance out the front end of the rifle for everything from just swing to just how the rifle's held if you're standing on target at, you know, high port all day or low port or something, right? Low ready. So anyways.
And even has a reservoir tip.
Yeah, reservoir tip. Yeah. But I bring this up because we are releasing a Cold Hammer Forge barrel, and we did this because we listened to enough end user feedback that refuse to own something else. And so we want to give guys options. But I want to be very, very clear about this. This wasn't because we noticed some kind of giant deficiency in our button rifle barrels. We're still going to be producing button rifle barrels in the new V2 profile. It's because, we wanted to satisfy the demand regardless if you saw a giant performance or any performance difference or not. Now, with that being said, again, if you are selecting the right blanks, or if your stress relief processes are good, if you're taking the time to make a good barrel, regardless if it's, you know, button rifled or hammer forged, if you're taking the time to make a good barrel, you're going to get good results. And one of the things I found fascinating too, again, reading the advice of the experts on the internet, people will get a hold of like a TM, or they'll get a hold of like the white papers, you know, from manufacturers whenever they suggest like when you should replace a barrel. And this is like companies that are selling things to the DOD. And if I'm not mistaken, the Colt white papers suggest in their scheduled maintenance is actually that a Colt M4 barrel should be replaced at, I believe, 5,000 rounds.
Yeah.
Okay. Now let me ask the folks out there. Do you think that's because Colt barrels die at 5,000 rounds? Or do you think that they might want to sell, I don't know, a lot of barrels to the government? And if you're replacing a barrel every 5,000 rounds as per the maintenance requirement of the gun, like, you know, how would you write that spec?
Well, even like if you look at like an aircraft or something like that, I mean, if you got... out of 1,000, you know, 1 out of 1,000 times, if that thing died in 5,000 rounds, that's not when you got to replace it. Doesn't matter if the other 999 made it to 15,000. Like, if it's got the possibility of dying at that point, they're going to replace it, which is silly.
No, exactly. And there's also the point of you want to deal with as close to mechanical certainty as you can, which is what you're talking about, right? I mean, like the fact that, you know, you might have seen one.
Yeah, weakest link.
Weakest link. Now, what I will tell you when it comes to barrel life, what I find interesting as hell is that if you were to take 10 identical barrels that like are that you can get as close to being identical as you can with whatever information is usually provided to the consumer, the difference in barrel life could be up to 30% or more.
Oh yeah.
Between like the best performing barrel and the worst performing barrel. And this is not something we pulled out of our ass. Like, we had to answer this question, and we spent a lot more money than our investor, our colonized.
We spent a lot, especially this year alone, on barrels. We've revamped our entire barrel line over the last 12 months, and it's been a lot of work.
We have developed an entirely new suite of products all the way across from the M4 all the way up to the Mark 10 and everything. So we have, you know, new caliber we're bringing to market. You know, I mean, like, so the amount of money and time and testing that we've done. I got to tell you, my view on this stuff is a lot different than it was just a year ago. And I can honestly say that a lot of the, like, dogmatic beliefs out there are simply not true. You know, I mean, we should compile this stuff and try to publish it to the, you know, without violating any kind of NDAs, or, you know, we get permission from, like, third-party testing people that we've hired to see if they're willing to let us publish some of these white papers and stuff. But I'll tell you right now, My opinion on this stuff, or my, I guess I should say, my knowledge on this stuff is, it's just no longer opinion. We have the data. It's a lot different than it was just just a year ago. And like I will tell you right now, the substrate material of the barrel has a lot to do with it, okay? And the overall quality of all of the other variables that go into barrel construction, whether it's a cold hammer forged barrel, a button rifle barrel, a cut rifle, whatever, if you start talking about bore consistency, chamber concentricity, even the effect a particular profile may have on like the changes in temperature throughout that kind of stuff goes. If you are simply shopping based upon whether or not there's a CHF in front of it or not, you're just the same thing as an OEM. I guarantee you that tells you so little about what to expect. Now, granted, we're going to try to publish as much of this data as we can, and then our specs and stuff like that. We want to actually try to, as reasonably as we can, publish what the expectation of that thing is. So hopefully that helps the consumer. This is partially why I wanted to do this podcast, because to me this last year has been truly fucking fascinating on what we've learned.
Well, and one of the things that I keep harping on is what is your precision expectation? What is your precision requirement? And how do you determine, how does the end user determine when it's met the end of its life? So from a first person example, going back to my PRS comp guns, I pull the barrels around on a 6XE around 2 to 2,200 rounds. It has nothing to do with group size. It has everything to do with my velocity starts to drop off and my extreme spread starts to open up. So it is no longer at the level of competitive precision I need it to be to engage targets out two distances out up to 1,250 yards.
But would it work for a deer hunter probably four times as long?
But no significant change in average group size. Yeah. Oh, yeah, it'd be a deer hunting barrel for generations. You know what I mean? But that's specific to that. There again, bench rest shooter doesn't care about velocity, extreme spread, all that. What's the group size doing? So his group size starts to open up. It's no longer competitive or precise. So there again, what's the metric you're applying to make this determination? You know what I mean?
And that's because my 6 Max barrel is an old PRS barrel with the chamber chopped off, and it runs like a dream.
Yeah, quite literally. His is one of my old 6XE takeoff barrels that I chopped down and turned into a 6 Max gas gun barrel. And
so you look, we're recycling.
Yeah. The green. I'm trying to be responsible for the environment.
This podcast is sponsored by Greta Thunberg.
But yeah, and how does it perform?
I didn't miss any long range targets at QB.
Exactly.
I missed some of the mid-range targets, but we can talk about that.
You want to show a couple of our new barrels before we sign off?
Yeah, I know for sure. So Kyle's holding one of our new, lift it up a little bit, dude.
So this is a Creedmoor.
Get it closer to your mouth. I'm just
kidding. It's a 14-1 Creedmoor.
This bag is hard. That's a 14-1 Creedmoor.
Mm-hmm.
So this is one of our 14-1 6.5 Creedmoor barrels. You notice the profile again. We're trying to distribute more of that weight towards the rear. But again, we didn't pull these contours out of our ass. We tested them with suppressors and wanted to see what the weight of a suppressor does to the point of impact shift and all that kind of good stuff. And we shot these things for groups and we burned up a ton of money and a lot of fun and everything else. And we found these fuckers shoot. That's another 6.5 Creed. What you got there?
So this is a 6 arc, 14.5 6 arc.
14.7
twist. Yeah. This is an SBR profile. And these are. You gotta move. Wait, there you go. All right, I can see myself. Look at that. This way. All right, yeah. So this one is a three groove polygonal rifle, just like the 6.5 Creedmoor. So that's a big change coming next year with the updated Mark 10s. They'll all have stainless barrels, stainless precision barrels in them versus chrome moly barrels in a lot of them. So no matter what, on the Mark 10s, the 308s, the Creedmoors, you're gonna be getting some a real high end precision barrel. And then these are small frame precision barrels are coming in 6 arc. Grindle 6 Max and 223 Wild from 14.5 all the way to 18 and 20 inch on the Max and probably 223 here.
Well, you are going to probably see some 12.5s and stuff in there too. The initial launch, we're sticking to those for right now. But for me, what got me the most excited about the Max, I know this drives fucking Clark wild, the precision man over here, but like what I really liked a lot was seeing the kind of velocities and performance that we're getting out of the shorter barrels and the implications that has for multiple roles in which you might want a very short, very fucking hard-hitting reliable precision gun, or, you know, or just the added lethality of that cartridge in a shorter gun, which we're going to be talking a lot about in the next week or two.
You want a little teaser spec?
Yeah, what you got?
So out of the 10.5 6mm Max, just playing with what we're going to generically term NATO pressure loads, right? Not a specific term, but just higher pressure than what you would ever see on the consumer market. But out of a 10.5, we're pushing a 55 at like 3140.
So you're getting 20-inch performance out of a 10.5 gun on a 55-gram bullet.
Yeah.
Think about that, because remember, as our job as weapon makers, and I don't fucking apologize for this. Our job is to increase the lethality of the platform, and as you know, different people ask you to solve different problems. You know, how do you achieve this, right? Well, I'll tell you what, you're getting 20-inch performance out of a 10.5-inch gun. So that is not like, don't get mad at me. Like, blame math.
Think of the performance you're getting with that same out of a 20-inch barrel.
Right. Well, exactly. Right. Now, yeah, or 18 or 16 or 14.5 exactly. Or 12.5. And honestly, what we saw, which I thought was really kind of surprising, I knew that it would have accelerated in this distance, but I think there is a bit of a leap going even from 12.5 to 14.5.
So in all the data I've collected, when you go from 12.5 to 14.5, you average 100 feet per second jump.
Right. So like, it sounds to me like, honestly, if you were to build a quote-unquote recce / fighting gun, and there is like a sweet spot for like kind of a multi general purpose, can you fight with this gun, and then can you shoot it out to like 1,000 yards, you know, and like could you serve both purposes with one round? Like that 14.5 does seem to be kind of a sweet spot in there,
yeah.
Doesn't it,
in that role? Yeah, absolutely,
in that specific role, yeah. Right, I mean, you know, it's not, I'm not saying that's not what I would go compete in quantified performance with on the in the no. Open class, you know, open division, but or, yeah,
hear me out,
yeah.
Maybe I will.
And for what it's worth, I think it was at the beginning of this year, I shot a PRS club match with a 12.5, 6mm Max in a 12.5-inch barrel.
So I want to
get some strange looks.
I want to leave you guys with this, okay? Because we're going to segue at some point. We're going to have Clark back. We're going to have Preacher back, because I know we didn't get into a lot of the shooting side on this one, but I definitely do. And real quick before we break, I want to approach this and talk to both Preacher and Clark about this, right? So our philosophy has always been every rifle begins its life as a barrel, and we build the rest of that rifle to support that barrel, okay? These barrels that we've been developing, and like this stuff that we've been chasing and trying to really kind of hone in to maximize performance, it is not developed in a vacuum, right? So whenever you pair this barrel with an M89 or L89 rail with that level of rigidity and that big giant barrel nut, and you know, and then you pair that with like say a broadsword upper, which has increased the rigidity of it, and you have a reinforced upper that has made carrier flight even more true and all that kind of stuff, paired with a broadsword lower, to which we've taken some bolt gun chassis technology and built into there. When you start looking at the entire system that we've developed, not just the barrel, but the rail and the upper and the lower and how you're bringing this whole thing together, does it make a difference, Preach, when you're shooting off barricades or tripods or bipods, the level of rigidity that's in the system itself?
Absolutely. There is no, I have no doubt in my mind that, because when you start to shoot stuff like QP and PRS, you're dealing with positional shooting. I have seen through years of competition not only rails literally fall off but bend under stress. There is no question in my mind that I can put my rifles through anything that these matches can throw at me and have. You know, it's like put it on a rock, sure, no problem. You know, throw it under a ladder or whatever, no problem. There's nothing where I think, ooh, I don't know if it can handle that. Like, no, I people are like, oh, it's so Cerakoted. Why would you do that? I was like, who cares? It's, if it can't function, if it can't do the job, then who cares what it.
Well, if I could interject something there to what Preacher's talking about. So let's say you have one stage to where it's a prone stage, right? And so it's going to be to your benefit to have that bipod as far out as you can, you know, to spread those 2 points of contact, right, to create a more stable setup. Well, think about where that load point is out there at the end of that rail, right, and the weight of the rifle and whatever load you're putting on it and what flex it's trying to create in the rifle. you come off of that stage, and the next stage is you're shooting off of, you know, like a Wee Bad Fortune cookie bag on a fence, on a gate. Now I'm all the way up to the magwell, right? So now I have a hung weight out there, right? Here my load point is out at the end. Here my load point is here. So if that lockup between that rail and that receiver is not absolutely rigid, and that allows the flex to happen, then that's going to create a dimensional change between my optic and the end of my barrel, which is going to create a point of impact shift.
And it's a lot more dramatic than people realize. I mean, absolutely. And so when I take shooters out and we're playing with stuff, they zero that gun prone or on a bench with bags, and they know where their rifle is shooting, and all their dope and all their holds and everything are calculated off of what they did off of bags on a bench. And then once you get out to 400 or 500 yards and you're shooting on off a barricade or you're shooting off of something else, you know, just the water line changed, you know, quite a bit, right? I mean, because the moment you induce any kind of stress into that thing, nothing is static. Everything's moving. Oh, yeah. You know?
I mean, and just to really to put actual, you know, a true scenario to that, you know, or I don't know if that's a mischoice of words, but actual scenario. Several years ago, and you and I talked about this, and I'm a apprentice saying this was not a Sun's rail at all. This is another manufacturer, but it was a very long rail, and I put an Arca rail underneath that, and so I zeroed it with the bipod at the midpoint, just literally sitting on the bench, trying to, with no influence on my part, right, using a hydraulic trigger assembly, is basically a syringe, and so right. That way I'm not influencing it. It's sitting by itself, and zeroed it to that. Moved the bipod out to the end of the rail, shot another group. I had a 1-inch rise in impact point.
Inside 100 yards?
At 100 yards.
No, okay.
Moved the bipod all the way up as close as I could get it to the magwell, and my group was 1 inch below.
Right, so let's say you're shooting.
That's just the weight of the gun itself and changing that load point out on that rail.
Okay, now let's say you're shooting a 1 MOA target at 400. Like, is that the difference between a potential hit or miss?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, guys, listen, man, thank you so much for sitting through this. If for some reason, by some miracle, you made it all the way to the end of this thing, then I hope you enjoyed it. And again, if there's any questions or comments, please leave them in the comment section, and we will be paying attention to it and doing our best to try to answer that stuff. I know this conversation is probably a little bit more technical or a little bit, you know, we're kind of in the weeds for stuff than we normally do. But I thought it was important to finally have a conversation about this stuff because it's been a really exciting year for us. How much we've learned in-house, some of the processes that we're doing, and I can honestly say that the performance expectation of our rifles today are higher than they've ever been in the history of our company. And like, we didn't get here because we built rifles that fucking sucked. Okay. We're taking amazing rifles that got us here, and we're making them even better. And I just wanted to share some of the information that we have found along the way, and we're going to do more to publish that data. Kyle, you got anything before we head out?
No, we're good, man. Podcast brought to you by Heaven Hill. Everyone always wants to know what I drink.
And Greta Thunberg
and the environment. Yes. We're recycling.
Thank you. From the earth.
Check out the new Precision Series barrels. They're all be online for sale. They're all in stock. They're ready to fucking rock and roll. Check those out. And you'll also see at Primary Arms, you'll see a lot of the broadsword rifles and uppers coming online here soon over the next couple months, and then they'll be hitting other dealers after that.
Next couple days.
A lot of them are already up. Yeah. So check all that stuff out, and we'll be coming back with more info soon.
Preach, got anything for us, brother?
No, I was just happy to be invited.
But, no, I'm glad to have you here, man.
If you are serious about
precision, he's a verbose man.
We're glad you stopped in before you went to go work for the fire department.
Yeah, either that or the pizza delivery guy in a 70s porn video. And like, he brings the meat, you know, the meat lovers.
You shave your face.
Clark, you got anything, man, forward that we leave?
Hey, I can talk for days about this stuff.
Can we have you back on pretty soon?
Absolutely.
All right, because we got a lot to cover. Preach, I want you back on too, man. Guys, take it easy. Go shoot and enjoy yourselves.
Later, guys.
Thanks for joining us today right here at the Liberty Tree Studio. But be sure to visit us at solgw.com for hard-use blasters, badass swag, and much, much more.